Greenhorn Radio is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Hello there, Greenhorns. This is Severin with Greenhorns Radio, and I am here today in the Hudson Valley on the phone, glad to be on the radio once again, and this time joined by Tanya Tolchin. She's an urban farmer in, well, near Washington, D.C. Hi, Tanya. How are you doing?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm super glad, but you're not in the political district of D.C. You're outside a little bit.
Yeah, we're actually in Prince George's County, about 20 miles outside D.C. It's fairly rural here. We're on the edge.
Oh, so you're on the ruraler side. You're not actually an urban farmer.
Right.
Maybe you could describe your operation for us.
Sure. So we are primarily marketing through a CSA, and we deliver to Capitol Hill, and some of our neighbors around the farm also pick up here. We have about 7 acres here on our farm, and then we farm about 5 or 6 other fields in the community. We were formerly certified organic. We've moved into being certified naturally grown now. And we market, I would say, about 90% to the CSA, and then we have some relationships with chefs and do occasional farmers markets at this point.
And was this your first career?
Well, I guess yes and no. We began working on farms shortly after college, and then I actually moved to D.C. and worked in the environmental movement. I worked for the Sierra Club for 10 years as a lobbyist and national organizer, and during that time, my husband and I kept our day jobs and moved out and started this farm, which is now more of a full-time operation.
So all along this was burbling in the back, but you were learning a lot of skills, I'm sure, that are relevant to farming. Can you talk about how being an organizer for Sierra Club might have informed some of your work today or how those worlds interact?
Sure. Well, I guess the farming actually started first. I worked on some farms when I was in college, and I think we, after graduating college, the idea of starting a farm was something that was exactly sort of in the background for some time. As I'm sure you know and have heard from many others, starting a farm from scratch when you haven't inherited it from your parents is fairly daunting, so we sort of took a slow road into it. Definitely the values overlap quite directly with my work at Sierra Club. My concerns for protecting the environment and for having, encouraging, I guess, community involvement in shaping our world are both certainly relevant and forefront to the Sierra Club work and the farming work. I was interested in doing more hands-on work, getting out of the office and sort of returning to the farm work, and it took us a little while to figure out how to do that.
So, yes, in a sense, the Sierra Club was your off-farm job as you built up the equity and experience and stability, and sounds like also family to go along with that.
Exactly. Not growing up on a farm, my husband and I had both interned on farms and, you know, done a fair amount of farm work. We knew that we liked the work, but I think we were a little cautious about jumping into it entirely. We had sort of considered options of moving much further out where we could buy a farm and try to jump in as full-time farmers right off. But we decided that it would make more sense to make sure that we really want to be farmers. It takes, I think, a few years. For many, the novelty wears off, and I think we were cautious. But we were able to both keep our jobs in the city, and I think it turned out to be a really nice balance at times when we really could appreciate going into the office and, you know, having an air-conditioned environment and, you know, a quiet place to work, and then the farm work, which provided such a complete contrast to that, being, you know, all physical and outside. So I think the two actually worked together for us quite well for a while.
Well, and so many young farmers have an off-farm job, and one of the things I've heard most frequently among kind of service providers is that they're happy to be the off-farm job for farmers. They feel like it as a support organization for farmers, to have actual farmers on staff adds value to their service. And,
yeah, I think
that. But it also they can provide the kind of flexibility that farmers need in their lives, and it's not always a two-way street. So it's a tricky thing to navigate. But if you do it right, it seems like it's a pretty core contributor to the ultimate success of that career in that farm and that person's sanity also.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, I think for many of us, having you know, the dual lives can work really well. I mean, sometimes there are certainly times when, you know, feel like they're in direct contrast to each other and in direct conflict, I guess, if it's, you know, there's something you really need to get done on the farm and you're off the farm. That's difficult, but generally I think that could work really well for many young farmers. I agree. And also I think it, you know, it gave me a reality base to that probably helped me to be a better organizer and a better lobbyist. It certainly, being a farmer and doing that kind of real work is always, that provides good insight, especially when you're working with people around the country, many of which do all kinds of work, including farming. So,
well, that's one of the things, actually, I've been thinking about a lot, especially since we have a dairy cow now on the farm, is every morning I have kind of 40 minutes of quiet thinking time that my colleagues who go straight into email, and I also used to be an early morning emailer, are denied, and that, you know, while farming may indenture you to a place and to animal chores and to lifelong poverty in some, well, not necessarily, but
in some cases, somewhat constrained
in those regards, it does give you your mind for free. And I think that, in fact, would complement a lot of different outer lives. And but the question that I had for you also has to do with the different locus for activism. So obviously, if you're in the Sierra Club, you're working on conservation issues and climate change. And tell us what is compelling from an environmentalist perspective about farming.
Well, I think I began my, I think some of my earliest farming motivations are actually still my primary motivations, which I think I began farming by learning some basic, I think, principles of both ecology but also food justice issues, learning that the world all the things that are wrong with the world agriculture system, that our beef production contributes to people being pushed off of their land and, not being able to grow the crops that they need in Latin America and in Africa. And looking at, I guess, what I think was some of my earliest motivations was looking at the world food systems and all of the many things that are wrong. And then organic farming seeming to fall into place as offering so many solutions, not always the big scale solutions that we need, but certainly I think the place to start. So the I think that was sort of my initial motivation. And then learning also that farming, I think, is such a great way to connect neighbors together to start working on solutions locally in communities. I think farms are, you know, can provide a great catalyst for people who are like-minded to come together and share experiences and then do other things in their communities to move their communities forward.
So in that sense, agriculture or farming becomes the kitchen, and everybody hangs out there, and then there's other things that they do, but that it is a binding and a glue and a certain shared experience that is useful for other is useful for other projects as well.
I think that's right. I think anytime folks get together in their community and, you know, find some common ground, there'll be, you know, it's easy then to take on other projects together and find.
I think that's true also. And with Greenhorn's work, you know, we're organizing all these events. And, you know, today there's one in the Pioneer Valley, and then on Sunday there's one in Boston. And, you know, there are kind of a lot of them, but each time it's a kind of a core group of collaborators, many of whom haven't worked together before. And one thing that we notice is that once they've worked together one time and have succeeded in navigating the vagaries of, you know, working with strangers and pulling it all off and no budget and a lot of logistics, it kind of makes it much easier for that synapse to fire again. And in the same way, you know, this abstract of community, the concept of community, becomes very real and very tangible when it's the phone calls and conversations and meetings and who's cleaning this and who's picking that up and when are we doing the PR and all those things. And that once you get that going, it takes a little while to get it going, but that it just keeps building once it's initiated. And somehow that kind of successional quality of relationships and of then the broader kind of community wasn't super apparent to me at first, but as through this work of community organizing, I feel like it's become so such a natural pattern and so similar in a lot of ways to the way that farmers markets work, to the way that farm business successions work, to the way that, you know, campaigns work. I think it's a very similar kind of a system.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think I saw also similarly many times with Sierra Club groups, and I think in my experience too, success, even small success, is really addictive. People get so excited and love it and want to succeed again. I think, you know, when you manage your first media hit, small or large, or have an event where more people turn out than you expected, anything like that, it's really fun. And people, I think, naturally might want more, might find that they, especially when they've exceeded their expectations, which happens in community organizing.
Yeah, it's
people
fun
love
to sing
it
in a choir.
Yeah. And I saw your posters for your events. They look amazing. I really like how they look. Looks like you're doing great things around the country.
Yeah, it was funny. We do all these panels, and the farmer's never talking straight into the microphone. And they're like, you got to get up there.
Oh, yeah.
If we're going to be spokespeople for our work, then we have to talk into the microphone.
Right.
You don't seem to have a problem doing that. Let's talk about your writing career and how the communication part of your personhood is continuing to exist and flourish in the context of farming.
Well, thanks. It's sort of my very new goal to try to put my writing more on the forefront. I think that I've had a long time writing aspirations, and I've managed to put many things first, and certainly starting a farm is, you know, one of the biggest projects one can take on, I think, in life. Starting a family as well, but I also spent years in my Sierra Club work very engrossed in many long hours, and I think that I was under the impression when I finished college that life skills are, you know, so are so important for writers, as they are, but you know, in that way, I think sort of put it on the back burner, and I'm very excited about trying to prioritize writing now and seeing what I can do with it. And I'm just kind of experimenting in different ways and having a good time with it.
Oh, so sorry. What does that look like? I was talking to Kristen Kimball about her kind of writing pattern.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the practical person in me who's managing a lot of different things, so I was like, well, when do you write? Like, is it in the morning? Is it in the evening? Like, before chores? When do you write?
Well, for me, I guess my, you know, right now I have two very young children, so my farm role is much more on the sidelines of the farm. My husband is doing much more of the farm work, and I'm taking care of the children much more. So what I'm finding now is I have a 16-month-old and a new 4-year-old that with a small little netbook, I'm just finding moments when they are finally engaged in play together or exploring together that I can sort of pull that out outside or wherever I am. Little quick bit of writing, and I'm not, if not something that I'm taking the, that I have a lot of time for and revision, but it's sort of this fast type of writing, which I think is kind of the way people are writing nowadays more anyway in the blogging world, seems to fit. If I have 30 minutes, I can write something fast.
And blogging is your format?
Sorry?
Is blogging your primary format, or are you publishing essays, or are you working on a book?
Yeah, I guess right now I'm mostly just doing some blogging, submitting some writing here and there. I'm trying various things. I have a children's farm story that I'm pitching around right now and some poetry. So I'm a little bit all over the map right now. I think that I'll probably focus in the next couple of years, but I'm enjoying just experimenting right now.
Well, there certainly are wonderful classic children's books about farming, and it would be great for there to be some new parables in the mix, and young woman farmer on her iPhone, I think would make a great protagonist.
I agree. I'm so tired of the cranky old man farmer character.
Yeah.
We definitely need to get new figures in that
pantheon. Totally. And what's going on in D.C.? Obviously, they're not passing any federal climate change prevention legislation. But what's the food scene like? And is the food scene infecting the policy scene, is my hope?
You know, I think it is. And we're sort of in a unique position for that, which our CSA delivers pretty much to Capitol Hill. And over the years, we've had many members who are working for key agricultural senators or working for USDA or the Washington Post and kind of, joining our farm but also watching national agricultural policy. So it's kind of an interesting connection. I want to talk to more of our members who are in that linkage. I think the food movement in D.C. is probably much like what you're seeing around the country. There's definitely significant increased interest in the past 5 years or so in terms of chefs wanting to put local foods on the menu. Many, many new farmers markets, of course. I'm starting to wonder if there are too many farmers markets. I think that they've certainly grown faster than farms have grown, although there are some new farms around that now. It's very hard for market masters to find farmers to fill their markets, which I think it's sort of a new problem and may, we'll see how it sort of shakes out. I think there's a lot more options for people for finding local food, which is great. Our CSA didn't fill up as quickly this year, and I think that might be a little bit because there's just, there are just so many more options than there were a few years ago. So we have to, I think, probably figure out how to adjust and meet the needs as they change.
Well,
but generally, it's all,
like,
I think, very positive.
Not reliable or predictable by any means. And, like 2 years ago, there was waiting lists on every CSA, and then some CSAs saw a drop-off, some saw it keep going. Some farmers markets felt like they had a harder time because home delivery came into their place. And
mm-hmm.
From a business perspective, it does, even though you'll think, oh, sure bet if I'm selling for $5 a dozen really amazing eggs, pasture-raised, all organic grain, there's never going to be too much of that. Well, a lot of other people might be thinking the same thing.
Right.
It does seem like the market research is difficult to do and still very, very critical. So you guys are filling like 90% CSA.
Yeah, and then, sorry.
No, go for it.
Yeah, and then I think the last bit is just selling to chefs here and there. We have a couple of very supportive chefs and caterers who will, buy from us almost whenever we offer, which is really nice.
And so, but you're keeping them as the people that you offer to them only when you've got something you can't move through a more reliable channel. Is that what you would suggest?
Yeah, I think that's sort of what we do with our with our chefs. We tend to work with them a little bit off season. Like right now, we still haven't started our CSA. We do next week, so we're selling some to chefs now. And then we also have excess flowers often, so we do a few weddings and offer some flowers to event coordinators when we have extra. And we might, we might find the need to diversify a little bit more. I'm wondering if the CSA bubble is somewhat, has peaked, or what exactly we'll see with CSA. But I think it's fairly easy, at least in our area. We have such a huge market with DC. It's fairly easy for us to make adjustments to join a market if we need to. So far, we've tried to keep things very simple, just one CSA drop-off and just pick up on our porch, because we found when we did, anytime you complicate things on a farm, it just makes everything so much harder.
Yeah, well, and that's so funny. I work with a restaurant myself, and, when you have the farm set of ideas and when the day of this is and when the day of that is and when the slaughterhouse is open and the restaurant set of ideas and the transportation set of ideas, it quite quickly becomes a negotiation when really your primary client is actually, nature and the needs of the crops. So putting in too many more clients into that equation can mess up the soup.
Right, that makes sense.
Or too many cross metaphors also can have the same effect. So if people are in the D.C. area and they're wanting to plug into the local farm scene, where would you suggest that they go hang out? Or what are some fabulous resources, events, networks that exist down there that maybe people who are from D.C. but moved away and want to kind of reengage, where would you suggest that they start out?
Well, I think the Future Harvest CASA organization, that's the sustainable farm organization for Virginia, Maryland, D.C., is definitely growing. It's not strictly organic. It's organic and sustainable farmers together. It seems to have quite a membership of non-farmers as well. And I think that organization is on the growing track. The Maryland Organic Food and Farming Organization, MAFA, is smaller, just sort of a meeting a year, but also really welcomes quite a bit more membership from non-farmers who are interested in supporting, and that group has been growing at our meetings some, but we'd certainly love to have more. I think if you're in D.C., I actually don't get into D.C. as much anymore, but there's definitely organizations and groups that are supporting local food. The DuPont Circle Farmers Market has long been, I guess, one of the strongest D.C. markets, and it's probably the place to go to ask around and find folks to talk to and work with.
So show up in those places, people. And Tanya, I thank you so much for coming on the show. I thank you so much for your exemplary, mature approach, the slow crescendo into farming. Any guidance you might want to give to people who are finding themselves kind of slowly transitioning out and moving into, from professional into more farm and family?
I guess I would say, like anything, do a lot of research. I think there are so many more options all the time growing since, the local food movement has been exploding. There are, I think, increased organizations, churches, schools, synagogues that want to start farms, there's rental opportunities. I think the old-fashioned model of that you have to go out and find the money to afford an entire farm with all the land you need is an extremely high bar for many people. And I guess it's important to realize there's a lot of other options, but it takes. It takes homework and connecting with people to find out about them. But hopefully folks can find a fit, even if it doesn't mean the huge investment that buying a farm might be. So
find a fit in terms of the balance, find a fit in terms of the land, find the fit in terms of the partner who wants to do the tractor work,
right,
and carry the mortgage, or wants to carry the mortgage while you do the tractor work. All these things and more are yours if you join us in agriculture. Thank you so much to you, Tanya, and thank you to all our listeners for your interest and for your, well, hopefully you'll start farming soon, too. This is Severin with Greenhorn. We are in the Hudson Valley tonight in Amherst, Massachusetts, a mixer for young farmers, elderflower bike ride on Sunday, events all the time, and lots to do for young farmers online and in person. In perpetuity. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, I came across a new website from the American Meat Institute and the American Meat Scientists Association. It's called www.meatmythcrushers.com. It purports to be addressing consumer concerns about additives such as sodium nitrates in your, ham and turkey roll and whatever, and animal welfare and food safety. I noticed as I went through the Meat Myth Crushers website, however, that it did not address anything like subtherapeutic antibiotic use in the meat chain. So I'm not sure how many myths they intend to crush. But, you know, as I always say, it's good to know what the opposition is thinking. And if you want to be fair about any issues around the food scene, it's wise to keep up with their press as well as ours. That's it for Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
There's no problem that Dave Arnold can't solve on his show, Cooking Issues. Take a little listen.
So Naveen writes in and says, "Hi Dave, I'm fascinated by chocolate, especially the transformation from the bitter seeds of the cacao tree to a tasty chocolate bar. That is a very interesting transformation. Are there any other foods that undergo a similar set of steps, fermentation, roasting, grinding? Also, do you know of any other tropical fruit seeds that could become delicious through such a process? Thanks, Naveen." That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously coffee, right? Coffee goes through a similar set of procedures, quite literally, fermentation, drying, roasting, grinding, brewing. Vanilla goes through picking, fermentation, right? It's dipped in, usually in boiling water, and then wilted and then fermented. So it's similar. And then I guess it can be ground to form a paste. But vanilla doesn't taste like vanilla until it goes through its paces to be fermented. In fact, the vanilla that's uncured is called red vanilla. You can get it. It's interesting.
If you like what you hear, you can hear a new show every Tuesday noon on the Heritage Radio Network, or subscribe to the podcast, or check out the archives on our website.